It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This time of year, many people can feel lonely. With the holidays upon us, sometimes it can be easy to get lost in the holiday shuffle.
We want to know what you do to fight against loneliness. What do you do to enjoy your time alone? And when you do feel lonely, what do you do to stop? And when do you think solitude becomes loneliness? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
Elizabeth Bernstein just wrote a column on loneliness and about when being alone becomes being lonely. She's a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and she's here to talk about this with us. Elizabeth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, something I didn't realize, loneliness can be kind of hazardous to our health. How dangerous is it?
It can be, and it's strikingly dangerous. There was a very large study done a couple years ago, looked at 300,000 people and found out that loneliness, being chronically lonely, is more dangerous to your health than alcoholism or a 15-cigarette-a-day habit. That's pretty lonely. That's pretty dangerous.
Any ideas why that is? What loneliness does to our bodies?
Well, it basically takes away a lot of protective factors. So relationships are very protective for us. People are watching out for us, brings down our blood pressure, all sorts of things that we get. We're social animals and that we get from being social and with people.
So one researcher says the rate of loneliness, however they measure that, has doubled in the last 30 years. How do they come up with that, and why are we seeing more loneliness?
Well, they're asking people, really. So they're doing a lot of studies where they ask people. But they're coming up with that number. The reason we are seeing so much more loneliness, a doubling of it in 3 decades, is a number of reasons. First of all, there's many, many more people are living alone. So that number of solo dwellers has skyrocketed. The baby boomer generation is getting older, and as they do, they're dealing with losing friends and spouses and isolation and separation, those kinds of things. So a little more loneliness there. And then nobody wants to hear it, but I think all of this time that we spend behind our screens, connecting, searching Facebook, doing whatever it is, looking at multiple screens, it doesn't really allow us as much time with people, making actual connections. So there's a loneliness to be sitting and looking at your computer all the time.
Some people argue that technology connects us more because we can, be texting with our friends and our family, even if we're sitting alone. Do you think that's not the case?
Well, I think it is the case to an extent. And so we can keep a broader network. So say I can be friends with people, sort of, keep up to date day to day or on a weekly basis with, people I went to high school with, a broad number of people. And I can stay more in touch with my cousins who live, on the other side of the country. But the issue is what's it taking time away from? Is it taking away time from people in my home, people that I can, have dinner with, connections? There's also something very protective to our health about touch, about hugging, holding hands, being with one another. Again, it goes back to our heart and regulating it and good feel-good hormones that we are released in our brain. So, you can have a lot of connectivity and talk to a lot of people, but it can be on a very superficial level. Hey, how's your day? Oh, cute kids. And you're not really getting the deep emotional connections that are sort of keep loneliness at bay.
Sometimes being alone can be awesome. Solitude can be a lot of fun. What is the difference between alone time and loneliness? Where do they blur together?
Basically, researchers would say it's in your head. So that line is in your head. And certainly, many people crave alone time. And a lot of people enjoy it. I enjoy it. It's great to do things alone. But it can be also too much alone time can tip you over to loneliness. But really, when I talk to psychologists and people who research relationships and emotions, they say that it's in our head. The difference between alone time that we might enjoy, it can be healthy for us to recharge. And loneliness is how we're thinking about that time. Are we enjoying it, thinking, great, I've got an hour to myself. I can take a walk. I can read a book. I can do whatever, you know, hike in the woods? Or are we thinking, gosh, you know, I have no friends. What's wrong with me? No, I don't matter. Nobody called me in the last few hours. You know, so it's this sort of narrative that we tell ourselves that can make us lonely.
Do you think there's a stigma that attaches itself to loneliness so that even if someone may actually be lonely, they don't know it because they don't want to admit it or they don't want to get help for it?
That's it. They don't want to. There's definitely a stigma. I really agree with that. I think sort of talked when I was working on this column. I talked to a bunch of friends, family members, people about, you know, hey, do you like to eat alone? Do you go out to eat alone? Would you go to a restaurant alone? Would you go in the morning? Would you go to dinner and sit down at a table by yourself and order a glass of wine? And what kind of restaurant? And so it turned out so many people said no. You know, I might go for lunch and sit at the bar. You know, I'm not going to sit down at a table for dinner. Well, why not? Oh, well, people think I'm, you know, what's wrong with me? I'll think what's wrong with me. Look at me. I can't find somebody to dine with. So there's a stigma, and we feed it to ourselves again.
So if we're feeling that loneliness in our brain, in our lives, what are some of the steps in talking to people about this that you found to break the lonely cycle?
To do sort of identify it. What am I feeling? Is, you know, loneliness is different than depression, which is really long lasting, you know, doesn't need to be treated. But, you know, what am I feeling? And it's okay. You want to not accept that stigma. You have to tell yourself it is okay to be lonely. Like, oh, what do I feel? I'm lonely. You know, I wish I had someone to hang out with right now. I don't want to be alone right now. That's the key too. Alone time is when you want it. And loneliness is sort of alone time you don't want. So, you know, you have to sort of tell you, I don't really want to be lonely, but it's okay. And then think of something to do, you know, something that you can enjoy by yourself. You can watch a movie, you can read, take a walk. Like, you know, what can you do that you can enjoy by yourself? And also, if you think you're lonely a lot, you have too much loneliness in your life, too much alone time that you don't like, you want to try to be sure to be connected. You can, you know, try to join some groups or volunteer. Or psychologists I talked to said, you know, even take yourself to the restaurant and sit at the bar, talk to the bartender. You know, there's things you can do to be around people. And usually, if you're around people and you want to talk, you'll end up talking.
I'm really struck by what you said about it kind of being in our heads about how we frame it. So does that mean that if we're feeling lonely, you know, we should really work on positive self-talk and, you know, changing our attitudes about it and doing some things to make ourselves feel positive about being alone?
Exactly. So you want to assess the situation. You know, I'm lonely right now. You know, I didn't really want to spend Saturday evening alone, whatever. But, you know, or my spouse is away on a business trip, whatever it is. But you know what? You have to tell yourself, this is going to end. You know, I'm not going to be alone tomorrow, or I have plans this week. Or if you don't and you're looking at the situation, it looks a little more bleak, then, hey, there's things I can do. I can take a class. I can, you know, go to the gym more often, try to, you know, join a class at the gym. I can do things that will help me feel less lonely. So you want to tell yourself, it's in my control to get out of this. First of all, it's temporary. If it feels it's not temporary, then, you know, I have control to fix it.
One of the negative self-talk examples you give in your writing is, I'm alone because nobody cares. Nobody wants to hang out with me. My loved ones aren't getting in touch. How do you change that negative self-talk?
So you have to, I have to admit I'm guilty of it. And I would be surprised if, based on the response to the article, that if many people couldn't admit it sometimes, that there aren't many people that would say it if they were honest. But you need to remind yourself, wait, you know, I'm sitting here thinking nobody loves me. I'll make myself count the people. Well, wait, you know, you just got off the phone with so-and-so. Oh, yeah, you canceled lunch plans with so-and-so because you had to work. You know, I'll remind myself, like, these are the reasons why you're alone right now. You're not, there's people who love you. There's people who care. It's just that they are also busy at this moment. You don't have to have your hand held every minute. What was interesting to me that the psychologists all said is when you get really lonely, it's tapping into something, not always something in the present. It's tapping into your early childhood and feelings before you're even conscious of them, of worrying that you were alone, like somebody wouldn't be there to take care of you. Your caretaker wouldn't be there if you needed her or him. So it's often tapping into a fear from much earlier in your life.
Let's take one of our callers. We have Laura joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm actually really excited about this topic. I'm somebody who chooses to spend some time alone, and I enjoy it. I feel refreshed when I do. And my comment was I think that social media has also played a role in this, that there's almost a competitive nature to being social. And people sometimes feel the need to go out and get social because they feel like other people are. And I think that is one of the things that kind of feeds into this this self-talk, this negative self-talk. So thanks for the show, and I'll take any comments up here.
All right. Thank you so much, Laura. And Laura's talking about technology, and I know, and I don't have it at my fingertips, but I know I've seen at least one study that said that spending too much time on Facebook makes people feel worse about themselves. I'm sure there are competing bodies of research, but I mean, I think that potential is there. What do you think, Elizabeth?
Exactly. I know the study you're talking about. I believe it was from Columbia University, and an important study. It said, yes, you feel worse the more time you spend on Facebook and social media, and exactly what your caller is saying, that it's almost like an amount of competition and bragging going on there. Look how many friends I have. Look how much fun I'm having with my friends. Here's pictures of me with my friends, with my perfect family. You know, it goes on and on. There's never anybody sort of saying, hey, you know, here's a picture of me with my cup of tea, reading my book Friday night, you know. So nobody wants to post those, you know. So nobody wants to, again, goes back to the stigma. But if you do, and I did it as an experiment a while back, took myself to lunch to sort of just celebrate some willpower I had, and then posted the picture of the lunch and said, here's my tuna burger and my iced tea that I'm having. I'm really take myself out to lunch to celebrate something personal, and I'm really happy. And I was stunned at how many people hit like. And so I thought, well, I might be tapping into something. People might be, you know, it's not the norm to say, hey, I spent time alone. I'm posting on Facebook. Facebook is all about friends and people.
Let's see a new wave of Saturday solo selfies popping up on Facebook this weekend. We're talking to Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about loneliness.
And we want to know, what about you? What do you do when you find yourself feeling lonely? Do you have ways that you cope, ways that have gotten you through it? And have you been able to reframe it so that you're not lonely, you're enjoying solitude? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking right now about loneliness with Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She had a recent column about loneliness and what you can do to reframe it when you find yourself feeling lonely.
We want to hear from you. What do you do to enjoy time alone? And if you feel lonely, what do you do to get out of that zone? Call us at 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Jackie in Drummond is with us now. Jackie, hi.
Oh, hi. I just revised all my plans because I was so excited about listening to this. I just finished. I'm a senior citizen. I finished my three-hour walk, and now it's time to go to my local fish fry. And I guess I'm pretty lucky that I feel comfortable going places alone because I lead a grief group, and I asked all my people that I'm dealing with, would you ever go eat alone? And nobody would. And I live alone, and if I didn't go, I would just be home alone. And I guarantee when I go into the sawmill here in Sealy tonight, I will run into friends that I know, and it's so welcoming. And one more statement, I think I would be lonely in a crowd in Minneapolis, but in a small town, you don't feel lonely. And I don't know if you covered those feelings you know, in your column, but now I can go in and eat because I told you my story.
Hey, have a great fish fry, Jackie. So, Elizabeth, what do you think of Jackie's story?
I'm kind of jealous. I want to go to the fish fry. I think that I can relate to that. I'm sure so many people can. But again, it's hard. The people she's talking about in her grief group, so many people say, I won't go eat alone. I won't go out there. And they suffer from, you know, deep loneliness, but yet can't seem to get themselves out there. Jackie has found the answer. She understands it intuitively. I don't know how hard it was for her, you know, to go there originally and do it things alone. But if you're just out and about, people, and you smile, people will smile back at you. You should do that. Go down the street and just randomly sort of, you know, don't smile at people like they think you're nuts. But, you know, if someone catches, looks at you and you meet eyes, smile. They will smile back. It's a natural reaction. So if you go somewhere, you sort of smile at somebody, you sit down next to them, you probably will start talking. And even small talk, just making a human connection, can really buffet this loneliness. But you can't do it alone in your home. So that's the key. You could. And about the small town, I have lived in both small towns and big cities, and I agree. I think that in small towns, people know you more. You feel known, even if, you know, you're not friends with everybody. You do feel known. You feel held. You have a place there. It's easier to sort of, feel yourself there, have a place in that community, be part of a community in a small.
That's interesting, because there's been some scholarship out saying that in cities, people are more social. And some people saying that when you live alone, you're more social, too, because, you know, as in that example, sometimes you're forced to go out more and you're free to go out more. So it's interesting the way different people process that. And let's go next to Jenny. Jenny's joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. I did archaeology in the field for about a year and a half, and what I would do is I would be on the road. So I spent 211 nights in hotel rooms at one point in time, and in a year, and it was a thing where I didn't have my family and friends. I'm obviously from Wisconsin, but Texas is kind of far away, and what I would, you know, was before I had a smartphone with Facebook on it. What I ended up doing is getting things crossed off my reading list and other things. Like I had been meaning to read a Mercedes Lackey series, but we were on projects for long enough where I could go to the local library, and I felt like I was doing something. We didn't have a TV at that job either. It was like me in a hotel room all by myself.
Did that feel like
six hours a night?
Jenny, did that feel like nourishing time, or did it feel lonely?
It started out feeling lonely because I'm an extremely social person, and it was hard at first. And then I realized, you know, it's not like why do I have to go talk to people? I don't have to just go talk to people for the sake of talking to people. I have me time. So what can I do with my me time that I want to do?
So you found things that enriched your life.
It was reading. Yeah, then I learned to knit and discovered how terrible I am at knitting.
Join the club. All right, thanks so much for that call, Jenny. And what about the way Jenny coped with that, Elizabeth?
Well, look, it's very admirable. It's a lesson for everybody. It's the way you do it. One thing is hobbies. I should have mentioned before, you know, so if it's bad knitting or reading or scrapbooking, anything that you do, hobbies are a great way to fill alone time. And TV shouldn't necessarily be your only hobby. But also, again, it goes back to telling yourself what this time, framing this time for yourself. So you're going back to this hotel room by yourself after work. You're doing it 211 days a year. Instead of telling yourself, great, I'm going there. It's going to be just me and these four walls and no TV. And, you know, after dinner, I'm done. You can say, wait, here's a plan your evening. I'm going to read for a few hours. I might write a letter, write my journal, do some yoga, whatever you do. I'm going to do all of these things, and I'm going to knock off early, you know, tonight so I can get up early. Tell yourself in a positive way, this is the nice evening I'm going to have alone, and it'll probably go that way.
Elizabeth, holiday season is coming up. Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas down the road. A lot of people may be feeling increased loneliness, especially if they can't be with family and friends, or they've lost family and friends over the years. Any advice for those looking ahead at the holiday blues?
it's a hard time. One thing we didn't talk about, which is very true, is you can be alone with other people. So you can be alone in a marriage that's bad or relationship, and you can be alone sitting at a family meal if you're looking around the table thinking these people are all crazy. I have nothing in common. We're not talking about anything real. We're just bickering about old things. So it can be lonely time even if you're with a lot of people this time. It can be lonely if you've lost somebody, you're going through it alone. The advice, again, would be to plan some things for yourself. So you have no control over how much time you can spend with other people, how much time you can spend with the people you know you would really like to be with, especially if they're gone. But you can plan time for yourself. You can do something for yourself, take yourself to a meal or to a good movie or a play or the opera, something, a spa. You can do things for yourself throughout the holidays. And again, the reading, not everybody's a reader, but reading is huge to combat loneliness because you just open that book. Your mind cannot read that book, especially if it's a good one, and go continue to tell itself it's all alone. It can't do two things at once. It's going to get into that story. There's characters. There's books on anything. I mean, you could read a book on any one of your hobbies or interests. That's another huge thing. Maybe beef up your book list.
All right. That's some great advice. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Elizabeth Bernstein, bonds columnist for The Wall Street Journal.
Coming up, we'll look at the record Dow Industrial Average close yesterday. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed yesterday just above 16,000 for the first time ever.
Optimism around the Senate Banking Committee's approval of Janet Yellen's nomination as the Federal Reserve Chair, as some positive jobless reports, they both got some of the credit for the record high. Joining us now to talk about this is Robin Farzad. He covers Wall Street for Bloomberg Businessweek. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hello, Cheesehead.
So, well, this is not cheesy news. 16,000. I wonder, is this milestone just kind of a psychological boost for Wall Street people, or is this really a big deal?
It's not really a big deal for the broader investing populace, which has largely missed out if you look at the big numbers over the past bull run of the 4 years, which is a period with which investors have drawn a record $400 billion of stock funds, and they're only now piling back into the market in true buy high, sell low fashion.
So it's a big number for Wall Street, but doesn't make that much difference for the populace at large. What, how far detached are those two things from each other, the number on the Dow and what the rest of us experience in our daily economic lives?
Well, the last time we really saw the two marry, for better or for worse, was in the housing boom, where Wall Street was churning out mortgage-related securities, and Main Street was enjoying this epic boom in housing prices, and we know how that ended up. And the last time we saw it before that was dot-com bubble, when everybody was talking about the market, and it was fodder for cocktail parties and salons. And if you watch The Sopranos, Carmela Soprano said she wanted to, that she watched CNBC. There's nothing like that for the past 13 years, but and yet we get this jarring number yesterday that we've seen this year, the biggest inflow into stock funds since the year 2000.
Well, as you say, the last time the market was high and Main Street did well, it was a bubble. Is a big number on like this on the Dow in and of itself a bubble? Or is this something that's going to burst, say, if the Federal Reserve stops goosing the economy?
That's the $3.5 trillion today right now. I'm saying that because that's the amount of stimulus that the Fed has thrown at this economic crisis for the past 4 or 5 years. Let's not forget that interest rates have been at zero, rock bottom levels since December of 2008. And then the Federal Reserve followed that up with quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3, effectively throwing conjured money at the situation. And if you plot those numbers against one another, the S&P 500 and Dow versus the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, they track pretty closely.
And I had mentioned the nomination of Janet Yellen as the Federal Reserve Chair, moving along, Federal Reserve playing a role in the economic performance here. How big a deal is it? Who is at the top? Who's the boss at the Fed?
It's seen as a continuation. Janet Yellen is not a a greenhorn to the Fed. I mean, after all, she was vice chairman. She's been very on the record of being simpatico with the Bernanke consensus of the past 4 or 5 years, which within the Fed is even controversial. You have renegade Fed governors who, if one of those guys, for example, the Richmond Fed president where I am, is much more of an iconoclast. Had he been appointed somehow, or had Mitt Romney won and appointed, I believe, as a professor at Stanford, who was much more hawkish in terms of interest rates, then you could see the stock and bond markets take a hit.
Okay, and the Fed always has to balance their famous conundrum: is our main job to keep inflation low, or to keep unemployment low, and balancing those two things against each other. Do you see any kind of change in priority there in coming months?
Well, because they've taken on such experimental campaigns, again, $3.5 trillion of quantitative easing, that they might have to change their bogey, because the stock market has detached really from unemployment rate. Maybe in the past they would track more closely, but the stock market has had far bigger gains at the same time that unemployment has been chronically high and the economy's been growing rather tepidly coming out of an economic crisis of this size, where you would expect a bigger bounce back. So if you see another asset bubble, if you see junk bonds take off, you see real estate in certain markets taking off again, the Fed is going to be criticized in hindsight if it didn't do something to pop that bubble before we have to deal with the problem, say, 10 years from now.
If the Dow has become so unmoored from daily economic life in some ways, are there other indicators that you like to watch that give us a better taste of what life is like, the economic life outside of Wall Street?
Somebody should really look at the use of food stamps in this country, which is still at a record, in spite of the fact that the financial meltdown occurred between the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009. So yes, Wall Street has reconstituted itself. Housing is back in certain markets, but this is very much a story of how the other half lives. Still, if you go out and seek out economic pain indicators, there are people out there who have experience. There are kids out of college who have degrees that can't get jobs. You have a record number of 22-year-olds living with their parents. So don't pay too much attention to the Dow. It's one thing that should be considered almost in isolation.
So one indicator that maybe was a goose for the Dow was some better unemployment numbers this week. Not awesome still. I guess that's the same storyline we've been seeing for weeks and even months. Are there things you're looking at that show any kind of overall bigger growth in employment?
There was a better than expected payroll number that we got most recently, but it's nothing on the order of the hundreds of thousands of jobs sustainably we'd have to create every month to bring this unemployment rate back down to the 5% territory, which, after all, they used to call the natural rate of unemployment. But we haven't heard that now for 5 or 6 years, just to underscore how deep this recession has been.
All right, Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. I love Wisconsin.
Oh, great. Well, stop on by and see us sometime. That's Robin Thanks. Farzad. He covers Wall Street for Bloomberg Businessweek.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, it's time now for Food Friday, and with Thanksgiving right around the corner, we thought we'd look up some expert help.
Our next guest is a national pie baking champion, and she's got some great tips to inspire us in our pie making efforts.
Joining us now is Michelle Stewart. She's a pastry chef and author of Perfect Pies and More. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you to have me. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're talking pies, which is something a lot of people look forward to on the Thanksgiving table. And in terms of, you know, the daunting factor of pies, is it hard to pull off a great pie?
It's not hard to pull it off. It's just a lot of practice and patience and love and determination, and you'll get it.
Well, one thing I like about your book is that you divvy it up into easy, I think moderate or medium, and challenging pies. So there's a stepladder there. What is an easy pie for the novice?
An easy pie is like really any of the fruit pies that you make. We use all fresh fruit, so there's really no reason to overmask it with seasoning and whatnot. So it's really just a few seasonings and cutting up the fruit and placing it into your pie shell. And then if you want to make it even easier, just make it with a crumb topping, and you don't have to deal with rolling out the pastry, you know, the pastry top, if you're too intimidated to do that.
Well, speaking of intimidation, I am intimidated by the pie crust, and I've even read, you know, fancy articles about the secret to the perfect pie crust. And I have to tell you, it's never been easy for me, and it ends up like little piles of shred of dough, and I have to kind of push them together and they look like a little gobbledygook. So what can we do to make pie crust better?
Well, one of the most important things is to keep your ingredients cold and make sure, you know, I use Crisco or vegetable shortening, make sure it's nice and cold so that it doesn't kind of melt into the flour mixture as you're trying to mix it. I like to use my fingertips when I'm mixing it, so this way I have control over how much I'm mixing it rather than a blender where, you know, you could, you know, have a good chance of over-mixing it. I also like to use ice-cold water when you're adding your water, you know, one tablespoon at a time. You don't want to add all your water at once or else you'll not be able to add it all because it'll be too gooey and you won't be able to mix it in properly. So, and I like to use a marble rolling pin when you roll it out because then this way you can keep your rolling pin in the refrigerator, keep it nice and cold, and this way, you know, you can keep your whole crust nice and cold as you're rolling it out as well.
Michelle, I'm going to make a confession. I keep my crust very cold because I buy it in the freezer section at the grocery. should I be ashamed or should I be okay with using that frozen pie crust?
You know, I always tell people if it's between you making the crust and not making the crust, go for it. And, you know, or I mean making the pie and not
right.
making the pie, just go for it. So rather than not making it at all.
Do you have an alternative to Crisco if someone doesn't want to use Crisco? Does butter work?
I honestly have never used a butter crust. I grew up baking with Crisco, and that was kind of like our standby, as my grandmother taught me. And
what does Crisco give you that some other stuff wouldn't?
It just makes for a really flaky golden pie crust, kind of like melts in your mouth. And you can actually see it when you roll it out. You'll see the marbleization of it, and that's what will give you the flakiness.
Now, speaking of cooking with your family growing up, pie is really one of those tradition foods often handed down. When you're trying something new, how do you balance the element of tradition on the one hand with the need to make something fresh and fun and new on the other?
You know, I think it's just really, it's families have their own baking traditions. So it's kind of like something that's passed down from one generation to the next. It's, you know, that's what's in your family. But it's always great to try something new as well. You can keep the old traditions within the baking circle as well.
Now, we have some pumpkin pie, haters in my family. But I think that the Thanksgiving table is not complete with a pumpkin pie on it. But you have kind of an alternative. It's still a pumpkin pie, but it's got a little twist, a pumpkin meringue pie. And I should point out that we're going to post this recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about your pumpkin meringue pie.
That's really good because the pumpkin, you know, we use all fresh pumpkin. We process about 6,000 pounds of pumpkin a year. And that, first off, makes, like, a big difference. I don't know if you've never tried it. I strongly suggest it because it's more fruity tasting, and you really don't have to put too many spices in it because you're getting the taste of the true pumpkin. So that's, first off, like, that's what makes this pie special. But if you want to use the canned, you can as well if you have a time saver. But it's, you know, great because this pie has, like, you know, the traditional pumpkin spices, and then you just add a little twist by putting a meringue on top.
I like what you're saying about not overdoing the spices because I really like the natural flavor of pumpkin and a little sugar. It doesn't seem like you need to go too overboard. Does that hold true for a lot of pies, not just pumpkin?
It does, yep. When you're using, like, fresh peaches or berries. And, you know, another thing that makes sense when you're using all fresh fruit is sometimes the fruit is a little sweeter than others, so I always suggest to taste the fruit before you actually season it or before you add the sugar and stuff because you may not need to add as much sugar.
I've gone the other way. Sometimes I make things that end up being so tart they make you pucker because tart apples or whatever.
Yep, that's why I always say to try the fruit.
I want to go back to the pumpkin meringue pie because we haven't talked about the meringue part yet, which is what makes this special. So you're beating your egg whites, I assume. And what does it taste like then? What does it taste like to have meringue instead of whipped cream on top of your pie?
It's almost like a creamy, but it's not cream. it's really good. It kind of cuts down on the taste, you know, of the spices and kind of all melts together, and it's really good.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah, and it's a great showpiece for your table.
Excellent. Well, that might, give the pumpkin pie a little kick in the pants for people who are a little bored with it.
Yep.
Now you have to make it, Veronica, and report back. Or better yet, bring the second one in for us to try.
I may just do that, actually. It looks beautiful. And again,
in my first book, we have a pumpkin pie with a maple pumpkin with pecan streusel, which is really popular.
Oh, maple. So do you just add some maple syrup to your filling?
Mm-hmm. It's a little different mixture. It's maple syrup and some brown sugar and cinnamon, nutmeg. And then we bake the pumpkin, and then you add the streusel towards the end of the baking. And it's like a brown sugar, butter, pecan streusel.
Ooh, that sounds delicious, too. What else do you think belongs on a Thanksgiving table when it comes to pies?
Well, of course, apples. Those are traditional. One of our biggest sellers in the store is our chocolate pecan bourbon pie, because that's my signature pie. But any sort of like apple, pumpkin, and a pecan of some sort.
Have you, so there's a traditional pumpkin, apple pie, sorry. Have you done anything funky with apples to make a really different kind of distinct apple pie?
One of our popular pies is like an apple caramel crumb pie. So it's kind of, you got a little layer of caramel on the bottom, then you got your apples, and then you have a crumb topping that's topped with some caramel as well. That's a really, that's a fun and a kid-friendly. I mean, every kid loves that apple pie, but that seems to be a popular one.
Can you talk us through some variations on toppings that we could try? Meringue is one. What else do you think might work?
Well, it depends if you're using, you know, for a fruit pie, you could do, you know, crumb topping. We have a walnut crumb topping in the book, a coconut macadamia crumb topping. If you don't want to do the pastry crust, you could do like a lattice crust to make it more attractive. If you were doing a cream pie, you could do different kinds of whipped cream. We have like a maple whipped cream. You could do a chocolate whipped cream.
We did maple whipped cream one year. That was really delicious and pretty easy. It was lovely to have.
Yeah, that was great, too. Like, if you wanted to do just a traditional pumpkin pie, you can make some maple whipped cream pie, you know, maple whipped cream to put on top.
So speaking
with your apple pie, it's good.
You mentioned the kid-friendly pies. You've also got a recipe for an Oreo pie in the book.
Yes, that's my son's absolute favorite pie.
Aha. How does that work?
It's really good. It's an Oreo cookie crust, and then it's got hot fudge on the bottom, and it's vanilla cream that's cooled and mixed with whipped cream and Oreo bits and whipped cream on top and topped with crumbled Oreos and hot fudge.
Okay, that sounds crazily good.
Every kid that I know requests that for their birthday.
Really? So kids will eat pie for their birthday instead of birthday cake if it's good enough?
Yep. And in the book, we also have a birthday cake pie, which is basically a cake in a pie shell.
Oh, here's a there's a picture in your book, and it does look spectacular. Hot fudge on the bottom. So that I like the idea of maybe mixing traditional and non-traditional Thanksgiving. There's no law that says you have to have pumpkin and sweet potato and pecan.
Nope, no, of course not.
Will you be trying anything different?
I bake thousands of pies for Thanksgiving. I take whatever's left.
You get the ones that didn't sell as well. They end up on your Thanksgiving table. Okay. And they're still good, though.
Yes. Everything we make is good for our holiday menu.
Well, getting back to crusts and the more non-traditional kind, here's one that struck me as different. I've been seeing a lot of pretzel rolls in stores, pretzel this and that. You've got a pretzel crust for pies.
I paired that with like the candy bar pie because I think, you know, sweet and salty at the same time is a great combination.
Yeah, that whole salt and caramel thing everybody's doing, I think.
Yep. Yeah, so you can really work whatever kind of your favorite candy bars into that pie.
And is the starch crumble just like a graham cracker crust, except you're crumbling up pretzels?
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Well, since we're talking with a pie baking expert, I want to mine you a little bit more about crusts, my arch nemesis, the crust. What do you think about, you know, those things at specialty food stores that shield the edges so they don't burn? Are they necessary?
I don't think so. I've never used them, and every time I try to use them, I break the crust. So, I mean, even if you just have some tinfoil on hand, and if you find the top part of your crust is getting a little too dark, you can always just top it with some tinfoil.
What about pie weights?
Those are necessary if you're making a cream pie or something that you need to pre-bake the crust with. I always put a piece of parchment paper on the bottom of the pie crust, and then I fill it with the pie weights, and you want to fill it to where your crimping starts. So that this way, when you bake the crust doesn't fall in.
Mm. So one thing that I loved reading your book, it gave me a burst of sanity.
Just a burst.
A burst. Ovens, the temperature of ovens and the cooking time varies, and you can't take recipes literally. Do I have that right?
Yes. That's what I found when I started my business. I baked, you know, out of my condo up in Vermont, and I went through three different ovens, and all three ovens actually worked totally different from each other. So I really relied on the oven thermometer.
Yeah, that used to drive me nuts. I'm too lazy to get an oven thermometer, but the cooking times would vary so much from the recipe. I thought, what, am I doing something wrong? Did I make the initial recipe wrong?
And like, I'll get phone calls too. Well, you say like 15 minutes. Well, and I always try to explain to people that, you know, the ovens are, every oven's different.
Every oven is different. So you just watch for doneness? Is that the idea?
Yep, and, you know, it's like an estimated time, which is in the recipe. So you kind of go off of that. But, you know, it depends, too, if you're baking with an electric oven or a gas oven or propane. You know, it's all different.
All right. Leave us with a pie that is really easy to make but really impresses the heck out of people when we bring it to the event.
Well, I would say, like, any of our, you know, in the... one of my favorites is the turtle pecan pie. That's a really good pie, and it's really not all that difficult to make. And it's traditional pecan, but it's got, you know, caramel and chocolate in it.
And what about, you know, for people who in your family who might be cutting down on sugar, maybe they're diabetic, what about sugar-free pies? Do they still taste good?
They do, especially when you're using fresh fruit. I mean, you're really getting more of the flavors from the fruit rather than, you know, what the seasoning of it is.
So a fruit pie would be the way to go for thick and sugar-free.
Yeah, yep. I mean, you could do cream pies, too, but, you know, they're not as good when you can't top it with the fresh whipped cream. You can. You're making fresh whipped cream, but, you know, they're not, you know, sweetened with the confectionery sugar and the right. yumminess that goes with it.
So maybe something like berries, raspberries, strawberries, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm, yep. Or even apple, and there's a pumpkin pie sugar-free recipe in the book.
All right, Michelle, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Michelle Stewart. Her book is Perfect Pies and More. And remember, we've got a recipe of hers. It was the pumpkin meringue pie, right? On the Central Time Facebook page. Check it out. Make it. Freeze it. Mail it to us.
It's a little self-serving. Yes, it looks delicious. So check that out.